Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio show. My guest for this morning is Dr. Pamela Weibel. Dr. Weibel is the pioneer for the community-designed medical clinic in America. Her model is taught in medical schools and featured in Harvard School of Public Health, Renegotiating Healthcare, a text examining major trends in American healthcare. In addition to this, she is also an award-winning and best-selling author. Good morning, Dr. Weibel. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
Fantastic. I'm excited to have you on the air with me this morning. I'm looking forward to learn more about your approach to healthcare and the healthcare industry as a whole. By the way, congratulations on the success of your book, Pet Goats and Pap Smears, which we will be discussing later in the show.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks so much. It's been a fun ride with the book.
Wonderful. Let us start by getting to know you a little better. Please give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Well, I'm a family physician, and I was actually born into a family of physicians. So I feel like my destiny has always been healthcare. And I've really enjoyed as a child going to work with my parents. That's when I first actually envisioned myself as a physician. And my dad actually would introduce me to his patients as a doctor in training when I was 5 years old. So I guess I was kind of groomed as a child doctor, you could say. And so as I got older, you know, and then went to medical school and got out into the real world of medicine, I found that most of it was kind of an assembly line mentality, where people are just like widgets on production lines. I was never really into that, so I had to do things my own way, which is kind of what brings me to the show.
Interesting. Your parents, or at least your father, is a physician, so how was he practicing his medicine?
Well, both my parents are physicians. My dad's a pathologist, so he actually worked in the morgue with, doing autopsies and such. And also, he had worked with at the jail and had some other jobs as before breathalyzers. You know, they actually had to have doctors at the jail to interview people when they brought in drunk drivers. So I would go to work with him at all these places. And my mom's a psychiatrist, so you know, I went to the mental hospitals with her, and it was just a great childhood to be able to interview patients and see, you know, the real world at such a young age. You know, most kids, the real world is hidden from them. They read storybooks with their parents that kind of glorifies a certain ideal that doesn't always exist. But I guess I got to see the dark side or the real side of life at a very early age.
I know you were playing doctor when you were young, but when did you actually kind of decide that, you know, hey, this is really what I want to do?
I think from 4 or 5 years old, I love it. I loved it. I really did.
That's interesting. Coming back to why you're on the show, what life epiphanies led you to a fresh perspective in delivering healthcare?
Well, I think there was a real big epiphany one day when I was doing a pap smear on a woman, and then the room started shaking, and the doors were opening on their own, and we were in the middle of an earthquake. And so we had to run out of the exam room. You know, of course, the patient's half naked. And we're running down the hall, and I see three naked people running ahead of me. And I realize, wow, these people were waiting for me in three separate rooms for their physicals. I had like four naked people at the same time. One, I was, you know, with her during her exam, and three were waiting. And I thought, you know, this really isn't the way to practice medicine. I don't believe in piling people up like that. It's just disrespectful. And so I just thought we've got to do healthcare in another way.
Well, how did you come up with the ideal medical care concept?
I decided that physicians really didn't know how to set up a clinic that would serve patients.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, what if I had a town hall meeting and invited my community, the patients, to design their ideal clinic? Then we would finally be delivering, you know, something that the end user values.
Right.
Instead of holding
them
hostage to something that's created by experts and politicians and, you know, people that really don't get it.
That brings up a very interesting question. Say you just got out of medical school, and then, of course, you do your internship and so forth. I mean, do they give you a playbook, I mean, basically, on how to set up your practice?
Nope. They leave all of that out. They expect you, I think, to just get funneled into these assembly line jobs or, you know, take a job at a hospital or something like that. No, there's really no education in the business of running a medical practice.
Interesting. I mean, yet we have so many private practices, and, of course, we have groups all over the place, and then there are even hospitals that are made up by doctors, a group of doctors that decide to come together and pool their talents to do things. So that's quite interesting in terms of now you are coming with a new, fresh perspective in terms of how to deliver the right kind of healthcare that you believe the public would like to have.
And some of those people that have their own practices, you know, they've got MBAs and all of that, but most of us are just winging it. We don't have, I mean, some of us have some, we might interview some other people who are successful in private practice and kind of just learn. It's, you know, medicine is really an apprenticeship profession, so we kind of learn from each other.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, you know, it's going sometimes, it looks like, in the wrong direction. We have a real lack of positive mentors. You know, a lot of doctors are really kind of discouraged and cynical these days. So,
Right.
Yeah.
You're right about the assembly line issue, because I read an article a few years back whereby I think a patient ended up charging the doctor because he was waiting in the waiting room, and time is money.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
So it's like, wait a minute now, you're talking about your time is money. How about my time? My time is money as well. So that was quite interesting.
Yeah, where did you hear that story?
I read an article, and this was a well-published article. It's been about a year ago. If you Google it, I'm very sure you can find
it. Yeah, I actually broke that story. I broke that story around the country. That what happened is I was on the phone with a friend. I hadn't talked to her in about 3 years, and she asked me, you know, how things are going in my life. I told her, you know, I just started my, you know, this clinic, town hall meetings, all this jazz, and I'm always looking for ideas that would, you know, that just would help in the healthcare delivery. And she said, well, you know, one thing that really pisses me off is when doctors keep me waiting. And I said, really? So what do you do? She goes, well, I figured out what to do. I started billing them at my hourly rate, which was $47 an hour. She worked at Boeing. And so I did a little, I asked her, do you mind if I just put this out on my YouTube channel as like a little 60-second, you know, newscast?
Uh-huh.
And she was fine with that. Of course, she didn't think that she was going to end up on ABC World News Tonight with Diane Sawyer. But, yeah, it ended up on the front page of CNN.com and all over the place.
Right,
and that was really funny.
Yeah, but that's great, because a lot of times, I mean, we respect one another in terms of professions and so forth, but then when you look at it, when it's all said and done, you have to be there at a specific time, and then guess what? You probably see the doctor for about 3 minutes or so, but you were there for about half an hour.
Yeah, the average wait time, I think, was 24 minutes, and then, you might not even get eye contact because they're looking at their computer trying to fill in flow charts about you.
Mm-hmm,
Not healthcare, in my mind.
Did you have a doctor or a person that inspired you to follow this thread of thought?
My mom is pretty independent, and so she's been self-employed her whole life, and I've kind of watched her. And my dad just is really, he just absolutely loves seeing patients, so that joy, I think, got passed down to me.
And
then they did set me up with this, back in medical school, they set me up with this cowboy doctor I had to work with for a month. He was like 70 years old in a cowboy hat and his, you know, old beater pickup. And that guy was really super funny, and he was all about just being a real person and a real doctor. That's what I loved about him. We didn't have a lot in common, you know, philosophically, politically, but the guy was not afraid to be authentic. And I think that's what people are craving these days. We end up just going to doctors. It's kind of like a cookie cutter factory.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You don't really feel like you see the real person. So these three people influenced me.
Very
my
interesting.
And this cowboy doctor from Galveston. He actually just died last week. He was 91.
Oh.
Yeah.
Sorry to hear that.
Sweet guy. Yeah.
So they were basically bringing their energy wherever they go, and they're by nature funny, I guess, as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Interesting. So what is an ideal clinic?
Well, an ideal clinic is designed by the patients.
Mm-hmm.
So when you ask people what an ideal is for them, you know, they describe a sanctuary, a safe place, you know, kind of almost like a chapel mixed with a medical clinic. You know, there is that feeling of sacred, you know, when you're, you know, honestly showing people the most private parts of your body.
Mm-hmm.
It really should not be happening like you're in a Toyota, you know, manufacturing plant. You should feel more like you're in, you know, a chapel or a place where you can really trust the person you're talking to. So it creates a feeling of safety, you know, where you have a doctor that's motivated by the love and joy of service. You know, we obviously all need money to live, but that shouldn't be the overriding feeling when you walk into a clinic. You shouldn't just be thinking you got to get out your credit card, you got to wait. You know, it should be a respectful, loving, warm environment, kind of like, you know, when you're sick at home as a child and your mom comes in with a cup of soup to your bedroom. You know, that sort of feeling, like somebody's really looking after you and you're comfortable and warm, you know, and safe.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the ideal. You know, when we're sick, we need to be cared for. So,
and I think
scared.
The familiar faces makes a difference, too, because I remember when I moved here to Dallas, I remember going to my doctor here. Each time when I see her once a year for my physical, I see new nurses that she's got in her practice. And so it is a sort of a revolving door. So you really don't build a relationship.
Right. And that's, you know, it's just nice to have a doctor that's in your neighborhood that you know, somebody who is familiar with generations of your family, you know, that delivered your parents or your cousins or you, you know. And that's what people used to have.
Right. But aren't the doctors themselves getting away from that in some ways because they find that they can't make enough money being a family practitioner?
Well, in some places it's more challenging, you know, in really poor areas. If you're going to try to go into private practice, unless you're taking a lot of Medicare and Medicaid, which does not pay well generally. But most places people are really willing to go out of the box and try to get back into what I call a relationship-driven model instead of a production-driven model, because that's what everyone really wants. You know, doctors, when they're interviewed, 61% of them say their greatest joy is the patient relationship, and then academic stimulation after that. So really our motivation, especially in primary care, is the joy of helping people. And if you can't have a relationship with them, you know, and they're just cases and numbers, it takes the meaning and the joy right out of it. And, of course, patients feel that. They feel like I'm just a number. They don't really care, which will increase your risk for liability and all sorts of other things, you know.
That's true. Very true. Where was the first clinic built?
Well, the first clinic that was designed completely by patients, what I call community-designed ideal medical practice, started in Eugene, Oregon. It came to me as kind of an epiphany during a time of despair. I had just had, you know, 6 jobs in 10 years looking for, you know, kind of the ideal job, you know, looking for a place where I could really be with my patients in the way that I had always imagined. You know, when I started medical school, I had an image of the kind of doctor I wanted to be, and apparently it just didn't exist anymore. And so I had to just quit. I left my last job and then decided to run these town hall meetings and just put the people in charge, because honestly patients and physicians want the same thing. We want time. We want each other. We, you know, we want to really go back to the humanistic way that medicine was practiced, you know, maybe before the 1950s.
So, interesting. During those back and forth, what kinds of specific things that the community wanted?
Well, the number one thing that they wanted is to be treated kind of like a they wanted to feel like they were in a living room with their friend who happens to be a doctor, meaning like that what you said, the family feeling, the homey feeling. They wanted, you know, small, nurturing, caring. I would say like human scale practices, you know?
Where
the humanistic parts of medicine, the love, the joy, the caring can really flow freely. So that was the number one thing. The number two thing is an integrated system, meaning they, you know, if they have a problem that you can't solve, they don't want you to just send them away and have them Googling for, you know, acupuncture on their own. They want you to be able to say, look, I might not be able to help your sciatica, but try Joe, the acupuncturist down the street. He's really good with this. So not this kind of, you know, like a used car lot feeling where you're either going to get something from my lot or good luck. You know what I mean? Leave people on their own to try to figure out what to do. So, just more of a collegiality among different healthcare arts professionals. And I think those are the number one and number two. I mean, there's a whole slew of things they asked for, but all of the things were so easy to deliver. You know, it really had to, what they were really asking for is for the doctor to be human again. You know, rather than the robot zombie that sometimes it feels like.
Right. Well, you have this little disconnect because you have this sort of like, I'm here, you're there, I'm examining you, but there's a really disconnection. It's not totally engaged where in the past, I remember when I was growing up, of course, this was in Malaysia, and you're right about that, where the doctors are very, very personable. They know you respect their profession and their position as well. So it's not something as an ego trip. They know where they are, and they're just heart-driven, basically.
Which is, I think, naturally what we all want to be heart-driven. I think some of us get indoctrinated or socialized out of that.
Right, right. That's true. So why is the ideal clinic good for individuals and families in today's world?
It's really helpful to have somebody on your side who knows you, who's looking at the big picture, because what happens with patients is they'll end up going, if they go to multiple specialists, you know, you're ending up with somebody who's really just looking at you for your kidneys. They have no idea what's going on in the rest of the, your life or whether what they're recommending is even culturally sensitive or going to, you know, make, or if you're going to be compliant with it because you even believe in what they're saying. So it's nice to have somebody who really gets you. You know, who can, who's connected with you and your family so that the treatment plans are appropriate for you and your values. So, and also somebody that's looking at your big picture. I mean, if you're just looking at the kidney, you might miss the heart or you might miss other things that are going on. And it's good to have somebody who's into kind of big picture puzzle solving.
You want someone that basically know you from a totality standpoint of view.
And that knows you as like an emotional, spiritual, and physical being, you know, so that what they say makes sense for you.
How many clinics are there in the United States right now that are considered ideal clinics?
Well, I think there's hundreds of them or more. It's just that a lot of people do this and don't necessarily tell anyone. You know, doctors are pretty busy people, so they're not necessarily, you know, in between patients trying to do radio interviews and talk to, you know, ABC World News Tonight. They're busy, right? So so who knows? I think that what it is it's just you don't necessarily have to do the town hall meeting piece. I really like that. I really like in advance finding out what the end user values so that I can meet their needs and exceed their expectations. But you know, the big difference between, you know, I would say ideal clinics and the standard big box, you know, clinic is just they're relationship driven. And that's just going back to how things used to be, you know, maybe before Medicare, before 1965 when things got, things were really streamlined. And so lots of people are doing that. You know, I think psychiatrists have very streamlined practices, even massage therapists, and there's have, you know, kind of low overhead, small, cozy offices. And I think a lot of doctors are just getting back to what works. you know. Mm-hmm. And it works great, I'll say, for primary care, for sure, even though specialists
right.
are doing this too. It's just that, honestly, if you just are going to the doctor for bronchitis or pap smear or hangnail, you don't need a team approach in a big building and a cafeteria-style waiting room. You know what I mean? You just need an intelligent person who's a friend who happens to be your doctor that lives down the street from you. You know, they mm-hmm. can see you pretty quick. If you're mm-hmm. getting a lung transplant, then maybe you need health insurance and you need a team and you need a helipad and you need a big tertiary care center. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
To talk about, like, you know, tertiary care, which is, you know, the more catastrophic things that people need that are hospital-based.
Yeah.
To talk about that in the same sentence as talking about primary care and the funding of both of those, it requires a completely different pots of money. You know what
mm-hmm.
I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
I got a question to ask you. You just brought up something that's interesting. I'm wondering, like, somewhere along the line, that concept shifted. So now we got the insurance company, we have the pharmaceutical company, and, of course, we have the doctors. And the politicians somewhere along the line got in this pot of soup itself.
mm-hmm.
Who is actually really running the show? I mean, the insurance people, they want to make their money. And the pharmaceutical people want to make their money. And, of course, the doctors delivering the services, and you want to get paid adequately, obviously. So who actually sets the rate in so many ways?
Oh, sets the rate that patients
yeah.
are being charged? The insurance companies for insured patients, which is like, you know, 80% of people, although I think
yeah.
now with the mandate, there'll be more and more that are going to be dictated by the insurance company regarding
right.
what they can do and how much they're going to pay. But, you know, it, for the uninsured, it's the doctors who are dictating
oh,
the
sure.
rates.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So.
Mm-hmm. Right. Interesting. So how can we find these ideal care clinics throughout the United States? I know I found 3 of them in Texas. So is there a way that people can find it in their neighborhood?
Yeah, you just go to idealmedicalcare.org and click on Ideal Clinics, and there will be a map. You know, there's a little link, find one near you, and you can just mm-hmm. be taken to a map of the United States, which has clinics all over the place.
That's interesting. So I presume there are more doctors coming online as well to be identified as such.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. More and more doctors are trying to do, you know, what would give them their quality of life back.
Yeah.
And bring back the joy of practicing medicine. You haven't met a whole lot of happy doctors, I don't think, have you, in the United
no,
States?
No, not really. Yeah, I mean, they are and they're not, I presume, because they own
mm-hmm.
this sort of, like you say, it's a quota system. You got to see X number mm-hmm. of people because I have this much I need to make to cover this expense, this. So everything is very structured. Everything
mm-hmm.
is very, very, very structured. From the sound of it, the fact that you were jumping from job to job and, of course, in this case, practicing medicine, and obviously you were miserable doing that because it lacked that personal connection that you were looking for, I presume.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, which is a real common experience of physicians. Mm-hmm. They move around from job to job more than is useful because, you know, the value in primary care is having continuity.
Yeah.
You know, knowing people over time really helps you treat them. So if you're moving from job to job, I swear I spent the first 10 years of my career telling patients, sorry, I'm leaving.
Oh, man.
You know,
yeah.
I was leaving more than I was arriving.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Do these clinics, the ideal clinics, accept the current conventional insurance program? Because that will be the other concern, I guess. People are so structured right now. Well, you have this PPO, you have this, you have that. You got to go to see this doctor, you got to see that doctor. How does that play?
You mean the... Do they take insurance, these in ideal
mm-hmm.
clinics? Most mm-hmm. of them seem to. Some of them are cash pay only. Some of them are, you know, kind of mm-hmm. like boutique medicine. I don't
mm-hmm.
know, you know, concierge medicine. Some of them might have
yeah.
a little bit of a yearly fee and then mm-hmm. still take your insurance. They're all different financial structures, but
mm-hmm.
the bottom line is that they have lower volume, meaning they're not seeing, you know, you're not asking a doctor to see 30 patients a day. They're usually seeing
right.
10. You know, a manageable number where you can really help people versus,
mm-hmm.
you know, just sending people down, you know, a conveyor belt.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
Are they more expensive, though?
These offices? Well, the ones that have the
yeah.
yearly fee, they could be, depending on what their yearly fee is. But overall, they I'm sure they save people money, because once you have somebody really caring about you and looking over your shoulder, I mean,
right.
I know that my what I charge is less than probably most doctors in my town, and people are getting what I call VIP for free, meaning there's no extra fee at my office. People are just unbilling their insurance, and they're getting, you know, instead of a 15-minute visit with a physician who's at a bigger clinic, you know, they're getting 30 to 60 minutes with me for not, you know, much more money at all.
Right.
So,
and of course,
that of the time.
You brought up the fact that you probably have less staff to worry about all that intricacy of the paperwork and so forth, so that savings is passed to the patient.
Yeah, it makes it more possible to take care of poorer people without feeling like your overhead is ticking all the time, you know, because that's my overhead used to be $30,000 a month.
Wow.
You know, I'd start every month with a $30,000, you know, almost like a credit card debt.
Right.
You couldn't really take a breath and relax or move any slower or see poor people without thinking that you're going to go broke, you know?
Right. That's interesting.
It just takes the economic stranglehold off of a practice to get out from under all that unnecessary infrastructure that just, you know, makes healthcare more complicated but not any better quality.
Right. Mm-hmm. I'm just curious, though, how did that structure got into place? I mean, is it something that the physician side of the equation that set up this, or is it somewhere along the line?
How do we end up in a situation now
with
all this complicated? I think what happened is after World War II, employers started offering health insurance as a benefit to their employees. And so more and more people started to have this kind of entitlement feeling that this came with their jobs. And so that it changed the dynamic between a doctor and a patient, which used to be a very pure relationship, kind of like between a husband and a wife. You know what I mean? A married couple. It's like you have your pure relationship. How many people do you need in your bedroom at night besides your spouse? Do you need your CPA and the insurance agent and the biller and the coder? And so what's happened is all these sometimes no value added intermediaries have been inserted into a relationship that should really be pure and sacred. You know? So you feel that, you know, when you're with the doctor, their attention is in like 30 different places and none of them are on you. They're on the computer. They're wondering what the code is for what you just said. You know what I mean? They're thinking of how to please these third parties versus just being present for you. So that's one thing that happened. And then that shifts when you get something, you know, with your employment, you get insurance, it's kind of, it shifts you out of that direct relationship with your doctor. The patient starts to feel like they can expect things for free or for cheap, or this just comes with my job, or, you know, why aren't you doing what my plan covers, that sort of thing. You know what I mean?
It just further
causes like a deterioration in that relationship. And what really sent things into a complicated realm is when in 1965 when Medicare started. You know, before Medicare, doctors were seeing older fixed income patients. They were just doing it for, you know, for a cheaper rate. I mean, I think back in the 60s, you know, when doctors would charge $5 for house calls, if it was a fixed income senior, they'd charge, you know, $2 or something. So after that, after Medicare, you have more and more people on what ended up to be a more and more complicated system, partly because doctors started taking advantage of it. Medicare would pay anything, I think, that the doctor charged. So, of course, the doctor started charging more and more money because they could make more because Medicare was paying them. You know, now we're in a situation where Medicare is trying to not go belly up, right?
Right.
So it's just, it's a combination of just having so many third parties involved in something that should be pretty simple. Here's the best analogy. When you think of primary care, think about going to a restaurant since you're Mama's Kitchen. You know, think about somebody bringing you a meal, right, at a restaurant. If you invited a third party to pay your restaurant bill, you'd pay twice as much for the meal. You'd have to wait a week for the table, and you'd have 7 minutes to eat. You know what I mean? We've created a very complicated, burdensome system.
too many people involved with it.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, that might make sense to have a third party pay if you're having a lung transplant, because who has that money? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You might need, for catastrophic, a pot, right, just in case. But for hangnails and bronchitis and skin infections, do you really need to invite a whole crew of insurance agents in the room?
That's true. Very true. Well, that brings us to the hot topic that everyone is discussing right now, is the Affordable Health Care Act, what's known as Obamacare. Is that the same as a health care reform in some ways, or is it totally different?
Oh, well, that's pretty much health insurance reform, is that what Obamacare is doing is trying to get for-profit health insurers to behave themselves, I guess, trying to regulate for-profit health insurance. You know, when Obamacare went through, for-profit health care stocks just went through the roof, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is great for people who are in for-profit health care. They're going to have more and more people that are under their plans. So I guess they can make more money, right? So that's, I don't know, that doesn't really change what it's like to go to the doctor and be sick and sitting in one of those cold rooms in a paper gown. That experience doesn't change at all, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That just means more and more people will have a little health insurance card to allow them to get in to have possibly not a very positive experience. Definitely not an experience of healing if you're waiting 24 minutes to be seen for 3 minutes by somebody who's not making eye contact. And so what's going to happen is there's going to be more and more people being seen faster and faster, you know, on this assembly line model.
And when
you see somebody quickly, you never really are solving their problems. So a lot of our problems start in the emotional and spiritual realm. You can't really dig into that in 3 minutes.
That's true.
It's probably great for urine infections or strep throat, you know?
Yeah.
You can see a lot of those. You could probably see 60 to 80 of those a day. But if you're really dealing with people's true source of their problems, it requires 30 to 60 minutes at least of a conversation to dig into that.
What you're looking at is like what caused the problem. And oftentimes you are not able to know what caused the problem because you don't have enough time. So you're treating just the actual symptoms itself.
You're just putting Band-Aids and throwing pills at people and maybe ordering unnecessary tests because you're now you're in a time crunch, so you feel like you got to do something. So you're like, here, just go get an MRI. And 85% of diagnoses can be made just by listening to the patient. And all you really need is a stethoscope in your ears and time. But look, we spin our wheels and, you know, we raise healthcare costs by throwing all sorts of drugs and tests at people that are unnecessary.
That's very true. So you don't think Obamacare delivers ideal medical care then?
No, it just puts more people on for-profit health insurance plans. I mean, I'm not saying it does. It's not, nothing's all good or all bad. I mean, it's great that more people will have access to care, but it doesn't do anything to change the situation in which doctors are so unhappy and patients are not getting really what they need, which is health care. It's kind of interesting, like all the talk about health care, and we never actually define what is health care.
You know,
what is it?
Mm-hmm.
Whenever you say healthcare, people just think health insurance. But they don't even know that they're thinking that because it's just been, you know, the whole conversation's been usurped by politicians.
That's correct. The spotlight is no longer on you. It's actually on the policy, the insurance, the coverage. It's not on you, actually. Yeah. So the word carries a different meaning.
Yeah, it's been taken over. It's really strange. And so when you say, you know, when you ask somebody about healthcare, it's not about what is ideal health care? The whole question is, who's going to pay for this? That's the question, right? Everyone just keeps
talking
about, who's going to pay for this? And meanwhile, when you're asking who's going to pay for this, you forget, what are we, how can you answer the question, who's going to pay for this, if you haven't even figured out what you want? You know what I mean? It's like we've bypassed the important question, which is, what is health care? What do you want?
Right.
It's like going to a restaurant and getting your credit card out, but you didn't get to look at the menu. You know what I mean?
They just offer you the food that they think you need.
Mm-hmm. And it's not even anything you like. You could be allergic to it.
Right, right, right. Very true. How can families optimize the benefit of the affordable health care to take care of their overall family health care need in this case?
Yeah, I think just obviously getting on a plan that has the lowest premium with the greatest amount of coverage, which with health exchanges,
yeah.
you know, they can, there's a little bit more price transparency, hopefully, going on, so people can choose the right plan for themselves, and then to try to find a really good primary care doctor who's going to be able to accept that insurance because it's not abusive or underpaying them, right?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
they're going to look at your big picture and your whole family and really do what's best for you all versus what the policy tells them or, you know, what they think they should be doing because the cookbook medicine, you know,
yeah.
we use that analogy a lot, cookbook medicine, where somebody tells a symptom and then you, oh, okay, that's page 39 for that symptom, we give this medicine. It's really
yeah.
kind of a dumbed down form of doctoring, right? So I think we don't want to feel like we're being treated out of a cookbook.
Interesting. I have run into a few friends who are doctors, and of course in Texas, people are very conservative, so they're all concerned about Obamacare impacting their income. And of course, this is where I'm looking at how can Obamacare impact their income, and then of course the big I comes up, insurance, what they will pay and not pay and so forth. What's your take on all this? I mean, is that something that everyone needs to be worried about, and of course, obviously, that leads us to more stress for the doctors.
Well, I think what's interesting is some people are being penalized in a for not participating in health care or health insurance. My mom, for example, she's 73 and she's decided not to accept Medicare as an insurance for herself. When she was a physician, and she was a psychiatrist in Dallas, actually, she didn't accept Medicare as an insurance. So she says, why should I accept it now? Now that I'm a patient. And so what's happened is because she's going to be penalized for having not been on Medicare all these years, I guess she had 7 or 8 years that she could have been on it, they're going to charge her $26,000 penalty if she wants to get on Medicare now.
Wow.
Which is insane because here's a woman who saved up enough money to take care of herself and
right.
not be a burden to society. You know, she has enough money saved to cover her all her health care expenses in her life without in needing a health insurance plan, right? But because of this, you know, forced for-profit participation in a plan, she's going to need to pay $26,000. It's $26,000 a one-time penalty, and her Medicare premium per year because she hasn't participated. Well, if she had participated, it would be like $2,000. Now it's $6,000 a year. So anyway, I think some of this is penalizing people who actually are able to care for themselves.
Right.
And it's just, you're just going to have to figure out what the hit is for each family now that everyone, you know, has to have health insurance. And hopefully some people will be able to save money and the subsidies available to poor people will, you know, make this all work. But
right.
in the end, if you don't have a happy doctor or a doctor who really cares about you, I mean, what are you getting with your health insurance card? Not much.
Right, right. And that brought up the question about this is something shocking. In the United States, we lost over 400 physicians annually to suicide. What's causing all this?
Yeah, just we've taken away the joy of doctoring. I mean, these people feel like factory workers. They went through all that education to try to help people, and essentially we were wounded in our training in a number of ways. I mean, I think a lot of medical students graduate with PTSD because we see a lot of trauma, a lot of death. We never have any chance to process it. Because of confidentiality, you're supposed to keep your mouth shut. You know what I mean? You've seen all sorts of horror stories. You've had to tell families that children have died. You know, you've had to break horrible news to people. You're watching entire families crying. And you're just supposed to shut your mouth because of confidentiality and move on to the next room. No time to process any of that. It's really unhealthy if you think about doing that for decades.
Well, there's really no news out there to address the issue. I mean, this is the first time I hear PTSD that's applying to medical doctors, especially the
mm-hmm.
ones that are just coming out of medical school. That's quite interesting.
Well, it makes sense to you, doesn't it? Makes sense that
sure,
having seen
sure.
all that life and death trauma, you know,
yeah.
and it's not like even, you know, say you're, you know, in a war zone, and you drop
yeah.
a bomb on a city. I mean, you obviously know there's a lot of casualties, but you're not up
yeah.
close and personal with them. Doctors are sitting in the emergency room, wiping the blood off of people's heads
yeah.
that are gashed open, telling families that they just lost their child. You know,
yeah.
you're up close and personal with all of that, and we're human. You know, even if we try to be robots and strong and efficient worker bees, we're feeling
mm-hmm.
all the pain of the people around us who are dying or, you know, chronically ill, and
yeah.
to never be able to process that is really depressing. So that's
right.
one piece. And then, you know, having to move at this high volume pace, you know, 30
right.
patients a day, that is really a toxic scenario where physicians aren't even taking bathroom breaks or lunch breaks. You know, really, to become a physician, the
yeah.
people who are most prized are the ones who are able to delay their self-gratification the longest, you know, meaning they
yeah.
are able to work, you know, 3 days in a row, you know, skip every meal, you know, and still
mm-hmm,
do surgeries.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are the people who are admired in medicine are these workaholics that
right,
basically
right.
are encouraged to abuse themselves. What kind of role model is that for a patient, you know?
Right, right.
So, yeah, it's really sad.
Do you have any statistics in terms of the age group of the doctors, I guess, in this case? Are these the ones that just coming out of medical school or the ones that's been around for, say, 10 years or so and they finally gave up?
They're all different ages. I mean, and medical students are actually dying by suicide at a surprisingly high rate as well.
I would imagine so, yeah. Yeah.
I can tell you a pretty depressing story that a gentleman called me who went to the medical school in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and he told me that during his training he lost two fellow students to suicide. One was a third year and one was a first year, and I think he was a first
mm-hmm.
year at the time. They mm-hmm. took the body of the third year female who had overdosed mm-hmm. to the anatomy lab and made the first years dissect her as their cadaver.
Mm-hmm.
And this is like the sadistic training environment that we're in. Who
yeah.
would decide for somebody to use their own classmate as their cadaver? You know,
yeah.
it's a mindset that looks at us as machines. You know,
right,
that's the reductionist
right.
medical philosophy, that people
right.
are just machines, and that if we train doctors to be efficient machines without the overlay of emotions and spiritual in life, then they'll be better doctors. People are actually training us this way, which is ridiculous because
yeah.
we are spiritual beings having a human experience for a finite period of time in physical form. And, like, for whatever reason, they're not training us this way. I think because
yeah.
just historically, you know, medicine has been about, you know, discovering things on
right.
on heartless, soulless animals, right? So, you know, a lot of our discoveries came from people who valued us as machines, right?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
But that's it's not what patients want. Patients do not want to feel like they're in a Toyota manufacturing plant. And
yeah.
the demographic that gets hit the most with suicide is really men. You know, men, white
yeah.
male doctors, middle-aged white male doctors. Those
wow.
are the ones that really get hit hard. And I think it's because, for a variety of reasons, you know, men
mm-hmm.
have
mm-hmm.
trouble asking for help. I mean, if you're lost in a car, I've been with guys that I've dated were lost, right, before GPS, and it's like they don't even want to ask for help from somebody standing on the corner or at a gas station.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And they're lost
yeah.
in a car. Can you imagine if you had mental health issues and you were wearing a white coat and you're a doctor
yeah.
and you're a male? To ask for mental health help is a lot more difficult than to ask for directions in a car.
Oh, sure.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And men don't like to do that, not the men that I've been with.
Yeah.
I've got
and of course,
by,
and, and
by
I guess
saying, let's
it's,
just ask.
No question about it. You're right. And, mm-hmm. of course, I think as well when you talk about men, I mean, especially being a physician, you definitely don't want to do that because that's something that shows that you're weak.
Right. Yeah. The whole weakness thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we're not supposed to be weak. We're supposed to be able to skip three meals and work 24 hours straight and have all successful surgeries. And we're supposed to be able to do all that on fumes, you know, on air. And it just doesn't make any sense. And so I think what happens is men, for some reason, and a lot of doctors do this, but I think men might be able to compartmentalize longer, you know, their life.
Right,
and then
all
of a sudden you get to the point where, oh, you're on your third divorce and you're going to start your fourth family and you're, you know, everything's kind of going wrong in the office. And you're like, men also with a high testosterone and the really easy access to lethal drugs that doctors have and firearms in the United States. You know, we lost three physicians in my town of 150,000 people in over a year to suicide.
Wow.
And one of them, it's like the receipt was still in the bag for his gun purchase that he bought the same day.
Mm.
You know, it's pretty easy to get guns.
Right.
You know?
Right. Yeah.
And I realized when I was at the last guy's funeral, who died about a year ago, he was a pediatrician in town who shot himself in the head in the middle of a city park during the day. And I was at his funeral, and I realized both men that I dated in med school were dead, one at 39 and one at 44. And I hadn't previously thought of them as suicides, but to realize at this guy's funeral that these two died by what their family called accidental overdose, which is ridiculous because doctors dose drugs for a living. We don't accidentally overdose. We dose on purpose, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think there's just what you would call a collective state of denial going on. Even among doctors, I considered myself pretty open-minded and aware, and I didn't even really understand that both these men had died by suicide. So it's a big problem. Yeah, and it's very sad.
Yeah, it is. How has your retreat helped to reduce these alarming statistics?
Yeah, I do a retreat twice a year at a hot springs up in Oregon, and doctors come from all over the world, come from Canada and the United States and Mexico and such to come to this. And the problems, by the way, are the same in other countries. Just because Canada has a different healthcare model, that doesn't mean the doctors are any happier there or the patients. So how this helps is, I think, just claiming it as a problem. You know, burying your head in the sand does not help.
saying
it out loud that we have a high suicide rate in our profession is the first step, right? Claiming it as a real problem. And then just, you know, I asked at this retreat, I asked how many doctors in here have lost a colleague to suicide, and every hand in the room was raised.
Wow. That's a
and
lot.
Then I asked, it's a lot. I asked how many had considered suicide themselves, and every hand remained up except for one. One woman put her hand down. So doctors are, you know, at some point in their career, even during medical school, they're considering, is this even worth it? Maybe it would be easier just to kill myself. And it's sad, our healers. I mean, what does it mean about a healthcare system if our healers are harming themselves at a higher rate than any profession? What does that mean? It means it's not working.
Right.
You know?
Right. The system needs fixing.
And it's going to happen when we get back with each other and we become human, you know, and really start serving each other locally.
Right.
Instead of waiting for government to save us, or, you know, obviously that is not going to happen, is it?
I don't know how that will work out, but I'm sure. I mean, intentions are good. Sometimes intentions are good, but that does not necessarily mean that things will work out the way it's intended to be. So that's something that we have to be mindful about. Let's talk about your book, Pet Goats and Pap Smears. It is currently ranked number one in the medical ebook on Amazon. Why is the book a must-read for people?
It's my 101 best patient stories from 20 years of medical practice. It's kind of like chicken soup for the doctor and patient's soul. And I think there's not a big, there's not a lot of books like that out there.
You know,
most of the time, healthcare, the people who talk about it on TV or in the media, it's kind of depressing. You know what I mean? There's not a lot of high energy and inspiration going on. Mm-hmm. So this is actually an inspiring book of front of the line healthcare, what happens actually in a doctor's office when things are working. So they're really funny and profound stories that I've had, all true stories with patients who've signed consent to be in the book, and so they're willing to share their most intimate details of their lives, you know, with the world. It's kind of like being a fly on the wall during someone else's medical appointment. It's interesting, and and so it's been inspiring to people because they didn't know they could actually have appointments like this. And medical students, when they read it, they didn't realize you could actually be in solo practice and still, you know, have this old homey neighborhood clinic any longer. So it kind of brings back, I guess, Marcus Welby, the old fashioned family doctor, and makes it seem real because it is in 2013. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
interesting.
Fun.
You had Patch Adams did the forward for you. And tell us your relationship with Patch Adams.
Oh, we've been friends for a number of years, and we've spoken at conferences together and such. And so he is very aligned with me as far as being a visionary about how we could have an ideal medical care system if we wanted, right? It's just...
Right.
We don't always have the will to bring these things to fruition. And so I think he really loves what I'm doing because, you know, to have an actual functioning, ideal clinic, I think that's what he's always wanted in hospital form but has never been able to manifest just because obviously it's a lot more challenging to put together an ideal hospital than an ideal clinic because it just, it's a bigger project. So, he's I think we're in the visionary realm, but he really likes that I was able to bring vision to reality with these clinics.
Wonderful. What life lessons did you share in the book?
Oh, just how important it is to be true to oneself, how important it is to be vulnerable with oneself and one's patients, because that's how you're going to get the truth, right? How likely is it that you're going to reveal intimate details of your life with somebody who doesn't seem to be paying attention? You know,
that's true.
It's really important that we're present and that we're willing to be vulnerable so that we give permission to the other person in the room to be vulnerable.
Yeah.
You know, I had a patient who recently came to me and asked her why she chose me or chose to get into my office, and she said, because you have emotions. I have depression, and I'm going to a doctor who has no emotions. And it just feels like a really weird conversation.
That's true.
To have with somebody, to ask for emotional help from somebody who is displaying no emotions. I think it's important just to be authentic, be raw, be real. You know, I mean, once we do that, I mean, things happen naturally, you know? As long as you have, you know, the medical training, you kind of know what you're doing for problems.
Right.
But, you know, you just got to be with people.
Where can someone go to buy your book, get more information about you, and keep up with your latest happenings?
It's on Amazon, obviously, and it's an ebook and it's a paperback. And I am somebody who returns every email. And if you want to call me, you can call 541-345-2437. I return all my calls. But my websites are petgoatsandpapsmears.com for the book and idealmedicalcare.org for the Ideal Medical Care movement. And, I would love to hear from people, and if anyone wants to start a clinic in their neighborhood or wants a copy of the book, just give me a call. And, I love helping medical students and physicians learn how to practice this way to get back with their patients in a real healing environment.
Interesting. How has writing the book and advocating the ideal clinic concept impacted you personally?
Oh, it's really expanded my scope of what is possible and redefined my perspectives on healing. I've been able to do so many more things for patients now that I'm listening to them and delivering what is of value to them. And sometimes it's just laughing with a patient. I actually had a woman come in with foot pain, and I had her naked foot, like, right in my face. We were laughing the whole time, you know, like we were old friends. I realized when she left, I never examined her foot. I was appalled. Yeah, I called her up to offer her a free appointment, you know, and apologize for, you know, I had her naked foot in my face. I was laughing so hard at one point I nearly inhaled the lint between her toes. I mean, her foot was right in my face. And in the end, when I called her to apologize, she told me her pain had disappeared. I never, so it's just kind of amazing what impact we have on one another if we are for real and present and willing to just be in joy together. That's another thing. I don't understand why medical care has to be depressing. It should be fun.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you have a bad diagnosis, you should be with somebody who has some joy and love and, you know, is comforting. And I really see medical care as something that should be more of like a, we should decorate clinics more in like a party atmosphere. That's why the goat is there really on the book cover, is people want like a playful down-home experience.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You really can't stay in the medical hierarchy with your white coat if you've got like a farm animal there in front of you. And I actually brought that goat to my office. It's super funny. She's a therapy goat. So anyway, yeah, I just think getting real, that's it. You know, we need to
Wonderful.
Be real with each other.
What advice do you have for the first year of medical students?
Oh, take care of themselves. Eat, sleep, you know, just keep your, don't let your, you know, stay actually in touch with your personal statement. Before we apply for medical school, we have to write a personal statement about what we want to achieve and what kind of doctor we want to be. I really think medical students should photocopy that and be hanging it in every room of their house to remind themselves why they're there. It's like having a compass. You need to see the North Star. You need to see where you're going. Because what happens in training is people get so burned out and exhausted, and they forget who they are. They forget where they're going. You know what I mean? And they end up being indoctrinated and going down a completely different direction than they ever wrote on their personal statement. I talk to these medical students who are depressed and cynical, and they tell me they're just in survival mode. And I ask them, well, how much are you paying for your tuition? They tell me $50,000 a year. And I remind them, you're paying $200,000 over 4 years to learn a skill set that will allow you to live your personal statement. You're not paying $200,000 a year to be talked out of your personal statement. You've been accepted based on your beautiful ideals and the type of doctor that you claim you want to be.
Right.
Don't forget to be that doctor.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
I think people forget where they're going.
Right.
And they get
right.
distracted and on detours.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's what I
Very
recommend.
Very interesting. By the way, we're coming close to the end of the hour. Since our show is about people, family, and living life, would you like to share a recipe for living with our listeners this morning?
Yes, a recipe for living would be to get back in relationships with one another. You know, whether it's your attorney, your car mechanic, whoever, be in a human relationship. Because once we can be human, especially in healthcare with one another, I think that we get so much more valuable information. There's so much more healing happening that we can't even really put into words. You know, just being human.
Yeah.
And accessible and real and vulnerable. So I think stopping the whole image ego thing a bit just to be real is the best advice I have.
Wonderful. Well, Dr. Weibel, thank you for the great recipe for living and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me next Tuesday morning. My guest will be Amy Newmark. Amy is the publisher of Chicken Soup for the Soul. She and I will be discussing their latest book titled Think Positive for Kids. The book is co-authored by Hercules star Kevin Sobo. The book is written for kids ages from 7 to 13. It shares stories from other kids who have made good decisions when faced with difficult issues. For additional information about this show and future shows, please go to FMMKTalkRadio.com. Thank you for listening and have a blessed week. Dr. Weibel, thank you again and have a blessed day.
Thank you. Have a good week yourself.
Thank you. Bye-bye.